Over 40 years ago, Jim Jones promised his followers a modern-day Garden of Eden when they followed him into the jungles of Guyana in South America. Instead, they found confinement, mental and physical control, and forced suicide. This is the final installment of our Jonestown series, and this is not going to be easy. Hi, Jada.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. I don't like this. This is not going to be a good episode.
Yeah, I am trying to mentally prepare.
Yeah, in doing the research, and just to warn our listeners, I cried a lot. And not like sobbing crying, but there were a lot of tears that went into this. I'm not going to do a lot of editing of this. I can't mentally do it. So I'm just going to, you know, take out, you know, little breaks and coughs and things like that. But the majority of it is going to stay up, including some pauses, just to allow us to feel this episode and not like rush it. So I don't want to dive in just yet, but how are things in New York with COVID-19 and opening up? And what's
So we've been cleared for phase one.
Okay.
And hopefully more stuff will open up this week.
Nice.
That's the plan. How's everything in North Carolina?
We are on phase two. But it's a modified phase two because we didn't, I guess, check all the boxes.
Okay.
Laid out by the federal government on what would clear us for phase two. Well, we did check all the boxes for the federal government, but one of them didn't look promising for us, in that we're headed in the wrong direction. There's an increase in numbers of positives, but we're also doing an increase in testing. So it's all relative, I guess, to how many tests are going out. I don't know. But I listened to the press conference last week, and so the modified phase two is no gyms, no bars, no movie theaters, no bowling alleys, those kinds of things, but they are opening up hair salons, nail salons, and restaurants, 50% capacity.
I
don't feel comfortable with it.
I wouldn't do restaurants.
No, not at all. I mean, so I hear a lot of things around like who's more susceptible to it being more dangerous. And since I have asthma, I've struggled with asthma as a child as well as an adult. Like it's like if I exercise then, or if my allergies get bad. So I'm trying to be safe for myself as well as my family. But also thinking about the fact that Jude, my oldest, was in the hospital last year with pneumonia. Trying to keep safe for him, too. And yeah, we're still not going out. The phase, they're calling it safer at home. And so we're taking that very seriously and ordering delivery for everything. but yeah, I mean, thankfully, my business is starting to like really take off in a great way. I'm getting a lot of referrals, working on getting some new clients. Really good. I'm projected to be doing really well by the end of the summer. And so I might not ever go back to a normal job. And I'm thrilled about that.
That's so exciting.
I know.
I love it.
I am really thrilled. It's really great. But yeah, I think my mother-in-law is coming down. I think we're going to Myrtle Beach in July. So Chris and I have already talked. We're going to take a no stance. Like we're not going into restaurants. Order delivery or pick it up and bring it home. That's how we're going to be taking that stand. Not just to protect us, but also to protect her. Since my mother-in-law is older. So yeah, just trying to really navigate all of this is hard.
It is.
Did not anticipate.
I don't think anybody anticipated it at all.
Yes, that's true. There was no anticipation.
And it got, it's like a wildfire, kind of. It's crazy.
Yeah. It got real, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Last Sunday, there was that article in the New York Times that posted all 100,000 names of the people who have died from this. It was very sobering.
Yeah.
And then to go to, I went and to the drive-thru in Dunkin' Donuts on Monday morning and seeing people without masks going into an already crowded looking was disgusting to me. Like, I like to think of it like the amount of privilege that you have not been touched by anything in your life, that you have no respect for protecting yourself or those around you. It just baffles me in like the most ridiculous way, because I just cannot believe it.
I agree.
But anyway. Well, I'm Alicia Galati.
And I'm Jada Smith.
You can say it.
And this is Two Sisters in a Cult.
Nice. I said it the last two times, so I figured you could say it this time.
Yes.
Today we're going to talk about Jonestown. I'm not ready for this. Okay, I'm just going to read what I wrote and hope that this goes smoothly. We shall see. Okay. To recap. Last week, we left Jim Jones after his epic failure with Sweet Angel Divine. He had started the Planning Commission, or the PC, to take his anger out on. He's beating them, he's torturing them with hours and hours of his monologues, all the things. The group had also started to have regular beatings of their members, and this is where things start getting taken to the next level of out of hand with Jones. It was during the early 70s that the church received its first negative media coverage. This is kind of the catalyst of why they moved to Guyana. But it was a series of articles in the San Francisco Examiner that profiled the church. It painted Jones as a false messiah who had claimed to bring 43 people back from the dead. Now, really, what happened is that his members, who were disobedient and disrespectful, would be selected during these tent meetings to pretend to be dead. And they, during that time, they would get kicked and pushed and prodded. And if they made any movement, their asses were getting beat when they got back to the compound. So it was like almost like a privilege, but also like you fucked up kind of way. And like you had to prove your loyalty to Jones. So you pretend to be dead and you'd be laying there and getting kicked and prodded and all this stuff. And then when he was ready, when he thought you'd had enough, then he would raise you back from the dead. So the authority structure of the church was also being put under the spotlight. And the Examiner articles drew the interest of other media outlets. Now, from then on, Jones came to view the media as his enemy, as an agent of the devil. Dun, dun, dun. Jones also began to shift his focus to major cities. Because of limited expansion availability in Ukiah, he didn't really, like, it's a small town. Decent amount of people, but still really small. He eventually moved the temple's headquarters to San Francisco, which was a major center for radical protest movements, and both Jones and the temple became influential in San Francisco politics, culminating in the temple's instrumental role in George Moscone's mayoral victory in 1975. So George Moscone went to Jones. Sorry, I'm out of breath because I'm like really nervous about talking about this. Deep breath. Okay. So George Moscone, he wanted to become mayor, and he, well, reelected as mayor. And he went to Jones and said, hey, what can you do for me? I know you have a really popular group of African Americans, and your church is super influential. This is how Jones started getting into, like, politics I didn't want to like dive too much into the politic, like the political part of Jones, because there's a lot of other stuff that I want to cover today, to like get this to its end. But eventually Moscone appointed Jones as the chairman of the San Francisco Housing Authority Commission. So this is giving him like more and more authority. And he really like, if it wasn't for the drugs and the paranoia, he would have been perfectly fine living out his culty days in San Francisco. But it was not enough for him. Jones was able to gain contact with prominent politicians at the local and national level. So he and Moscone met privately with vice presidential candidate Walter Mondale on his campaign plane just days before the 1976 election, leading Mondale to publicly praise the temple. So he was like getting in the ear of all these people, and they were like, oh no, he's doing great things. First Lady Rosalynn Carter, Jimmy Carter's wife, even met Jones on multiple occasions and corresponded with him about Cuba and spoke to him at the grand opening of the San Francisco headquarters, where he received louder applause than she did when she was like announced.
That's wild.
And one podcast I was listening to, they said that it's like she went and visited their like their group when they were still in California, and as soon as she left, he was like, you know, she wants you to put wants to put you in concentration camps, right? Like, he was always twisting it to like, I'm the one who knows what's going on and everyone else is against him.
Jesus.
It was during the summer of 1973 that Jones made the decision to relocate People's Temple to South America, and he was looking specifically at Guyana. So 2 months later, he visited the country in order to open negotiations to purchase 27,000 acres of land in the Matthew Ridge area near the Venezuelan border. In 1974, Jones bought the land in Guyana. Oh, I'm not a history buff by any means at all, but from what I understand, this is why Jones was able to buy such a large property in Guyana. Now, Guyana had received freedom from Great Britain in 1966, and that was great, except that meant that Guyana had no longer was no longer protected from Venezuela, which if you look at a map, Venezuela is like huge compared to Guyana. And they were like constantly pushing the border further and further into Guyana. And Guyana didn't have a like big army at all. And it was mostly filled with like younger, young adult boys who had nowhere else to go, who were just looking for a meal. So they needed help. And they knew that if Jones came in and was able to create like an American establishment, they might have extra protection. You know what I mean? There were Americans on their land. So that allowed Jones to purchase the property. And he would actually be bringing his own armed forces with him, because he wanted it to be his own socialist group. And he didn't want the military involved, but the Guyan government knew that if something did go down, at least the American government would be like, hey, we've got you. So now I want to talk about Jones's right-hand woman, Carolyn Layton. She was one of the church administrators, but she was like top dog. And she had undergone several abortions by the time that she gave Jones an ultimatum. She was like, look, Grace Stowen from last episode, if you didn't listen, you rebel, you. I love calling you guys rebels. But I'm totally like that person where I'm like, maybe I'll listen, maybe I won't. I don't know. So I get it. But Grace Stowen got pregnant from Jones, and or allegedly got pregnant from Jones, and was able to keep her child. And Jones had had all the other women force them to get abortions. So Carolyn was like, look, I want to have your baby. This is it. I'm not like, I'm in your inner circle. I am up your butt. I know exactly what's going on. You can't fool me anymore. I want your baby. So She got pregnant and went away to her parents to have the child. You know, but according to People's Temple members, she was on a mission to Mexico. So he said that she had to go to the secret mission in Mexico, and then she came back with a baby. So to fix this, he said during her time in Mexico, she was imprisoned for her beliefs, and then she was raped in the prison. That's where the child came from.
Allswell believes in the power of a good night's sleep for all. It's been their guiding principle since the moment that they launched. Their mattresses are designed to make good sleep accessible to everyone. The Allswell features hybrid mattress technology combining the best of both worlds, memory foam and individual coils. A winning blend for comfort and support. Love it. Their goal is to create an affordable mattress without sacrificing quality or luxury. So what's the result? The Allswell Queen mattress costs only $345. And no, that is not a joke. Their Queen mattress is only $345. By using our special link, you can get free shipping, a 10-year limited warranty, and 100 nights risk-free trial. Definitely go check it out. You can find our link in the show notes. That lets Allswell know that we sent you and helps to support our show. Or you can simply go to twosisterscult.com/savings and you'll be able to find the link on our page. We have all our favorite things on there, but definitely go check out Allswell and get yourself a queen mattress. Allswell, dreamy mattresses for real life.
Which made her a martyr. Like, he's always constantly turning things to be like, look at how awesome I am. Look at how great my members are. You guys shouldn't complain. Carolyn got raped in a prison. I mean, I fucked her. What? I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah.
He sucks.
He sucks big time. So he said that's where the child came from. Carolyn was one of the very few members who were actually allowed to keep and raise her child. Most of the members, their children were raised communally, which it kind of makes me think a little bit on the camp. Like, yes, we had our mom, but it was very much like group judgment, group training, group teaching, group, like, separate the children from the mothers so that the mothers can, quote, get the help they need while the children are learning about Jesus and God and stuff. You know what I'm saying?
And sometimes math and science.
Man, I wish there was more math and science. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Give me the math and science, not the history. History sucks.
And it's also very similar, I think, in that the person in charge ultimately has the last say in how the children are dealt with.
Yeah. Absolutely. So Jones is positioning himself as, quote, father of all. And speaking of Grace Stowen, she defected from People's Temple and ran off with a new lover during some 4th of July fireworks. Now, problem is she left her son with her husband, Tim Stowen. Jones took this defection and all the other defections that happened, like, it could have been the smallest person in his group who, like, was irrelevant. Every defection he took personally as a personal offense to him, because that's how high and mighty he thought of himself. And this defection, Grace Stowen leaving, that rocked him. And in order to keep Grace from getting her son, he shipped young John Victor and Tim Stowen to Guyana. And little John would never come back to the United States alive. The first People's Temple members who arrived in Guyana in March 1974 were bringing, like, they were supposed to clear the jungle because there, what had been promised as a tropical paradise, was actually just thick brush and dusty land. Like, it was like, Guyana is beautiful and there are jungles and it's gorgeous, but the land that the Guyanan government, or however you say that, the government of Guyana Gabe Jones was not good land at all. It was pretty much like a wasteland. So they were supposed to go in, break ground for construction on what was to become Jonestown. A year later, 50 People's Temple members pioneered their way into Guyana. Day and night, they're working on construction, they're building, and they're establishing a massive agricultural project. This agricultural project did not actually bear a lot of fruit. And honestly, Jonestown was not even meant to house over 500 people. Like, it was only supposed to be for a couple hundred. But when the article came out and more speculation went on Jones, he rushed everyone to move into Guyana. So by 1977, Jonestown was an established community. And things were getting worse and worse. And on Memorial Day, along with 700 congregation members, Jones made an appearance at a commemoration for suicide, for those who had committed suicide by jumping off of the San Francisco Golden... Blah. Blah. Let me start this over. By 1977, Jonestown was an established community. But it was only established for like a couple hundred people, right? Mm-hmm. But things were getting worse back in California, and Jones was like under the heat. So on Memorial Day in 1977, along with 600 congregation members, Jones made an appearance at a commemorative event for those who had jumped off of the Golden Gate Bridge to commit suicide. And in his address that day, he declared, "I have been in a suicidal mood myself today, so I have personal empathy for what we are doing here today." This man is clearly off his rocker.
Yeah.
By September, there were more than 1,000 People's Temple members, with only 50 or so left back in the United States. Now, the sudden influx, because Jones is preaching, we need to get out of the United States because they're coming for us, that put a serious strain on the facilities in Jonestown. But members were super enthusiastic. They were ready to pitch in, to accommodate all the demand, to figure it out and make it work. And 3/4 of the transplanted residents were Black. We got to remember, like, most of his group and his people were African American, with the remainder being White, Hispanic, Asian, and Native American. The task of feeding, housing, clothing the community was a massive undertaking. But the temple members, thinking like, this is socialism, found a sense of pride in what they were accomplishing. And despite the harsh conditions and the hard work, the people appeared, for the first few months at least, genuinely happy. And I feel like that's how it was. Not to equate the camp to Jonestown, because I don't think it was the same.
No.
But that first few months of like, it's going to be great. We're doing something good. Mom's getting the help she needs. Yay. Wait a minute. What's going on?
I think it's a testament to the beauty that's in humanity that they can make something like that. A beautiful, beautiful group thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there's a lot to be said for the people that were in People's Temple, because from everything I've read and listened to and watched, they were great people, like genuinely kind, loving, caring people. And it's like Jones just took advantage of that. And growing tensions started to happen in the autumn of 1977 when Tim Stowen, who had left the temple without his son, mind you. So Tim Stowen's back in the United States. Grace is in the United States. And their son, John, is in Guyana. But Tim Stowen wanted to, like, get his kid back. And so did Grace. They were fighting to try to get custody of their kid, which is kind of what led to everything going down, which we'll see. So he formed a concerned relatives group that became, that was like from all the people whose family members were in Jonestown. Like, they were concerned. And he traveled to Washington, D.C. in January 1978 to visit with State Department officials and members of Congress. And he wrote a white paper detailing his grievances against Joan and the temple. On April 11th, 1978, the concerned relatives distributed a packet of documents, letters, and affidavits to the People's Temple, members of the press, members of Congress, which they had titled An Accusation of Human Rights Violation by Reverend James Warren Jones. And in June 1978, escaped temple member Deborah Layton provided the group with a further affidavit detailing crimes by the temple and substandard living conditions in Jonestown. But Jones is facing increasing scrutiny. He is freaking out because, like, all these people are looking at him now. And you got to think, like, back to when he was little. And he was admiring Hitler, that when he was under fire, he committed suicide. That he would rather take his own life than be captured. Like, this is the same man who felt like that as a child. So what is he actually going to do? You know?
Right.
So Jones decided to hire JFK assassination conspiracy theorist Mark Lane and Donald Freed to help make the case of a grand conspiracy against the temple by U.S. intelligence agencies. Oh my God, this guy is like, he told Lane that he wanted to, quote, pull an Elridge Cleaver, referring to a fugitive member of the Black Panthers who was able to return to the U.S. after repairing his reputation. Like, the fact that this white man
right,
like, I'm just like that black guy.
No. No. Honey, no.
Paranoia only got worse. Jones knew that his people were plotting against him, which they're not. They just want to go home. There are so many people at this point that they're like, you know, I didn't really sign up for this. Like, this is a lot. This is hard work. They are working themselves practically to the bone. He started conducting mass suicide drills to keep everyone in line. His followers were woken up in the middle of the night. They'd receive a cup with a red liquid that they were told contained poison, which they were ordered to drink it. And after 45 minutes or so, the members were told that they were not going to die and that they had passed a loyalty test.
Fuck Jones.
Yes.
Fuck Jones.
Yep.
What the fuck?
Yeah. Now I want to talk a little bit about Christine Miller. She is one badass woman in that she was one of the only members who stood up to Jones on that last day. But I want to talk a little bit about her story. Christine Miller arrived in Jonestown on January 3rd, 1978. She was not a member of the Inner Circle, but was one of the members who simply refused to give up the things that she had worked so hard for. She was an African-American woman who wrote in letters to Jones, which that's how we know this, about how she worked in cotton fields and lost her mother at a young age. She put herself up by bootstrapping and working her ass off, and that hard work paid off. She was able to move from Texas to Los Angeles and had enough money to buy a home, a car, jewelry, and furs. Like, this is one badass African-American woman. You know what I mean? Like, if you think of the time and, like, just all of the racial things that were already going on, badass woman.
Yeah.
When she made it to Jonestown, she wrote multiple letters to Jones about how she felt that she had come too far to be pushed as hard as she was being pushed in Jonestown. Like, listen, she was born in, like, 1919 or something. So at this point, she's in her 50s, early 60s, maybe. And she's like, listen, I have worked my ass off. I don't need to be working this hard anymore. Like, let me find a different way to help. She felt that she would be more valuable back in America where she could work and donate her check to the cause. Like, she's still giving up things and like, hey, I can help. But in Jonestown, she felt like a liability and she was accustomed to being an asset. And she was also accustomed to being treated like an asset. She's like, look, I know how I feel, how I want to be felt. I know how I like enjoy giving, but come on. I don't want to do this that much.
No.
In one meeting, Christine and Jones exchanged words. And it got heated. Jones had gotten into the habit of handling guns during these meetings. And at least one taped recording from late March in 1978 picked up on the sound of Jones firing a shot to wake up people in the crowd who were sleeping.
Oh my gosh.
Additionally, the isolation of the community with Jones's word as sole authority put anyone who opposed him in a very vulnerable position. Mm. A troublesome person could get put in a sensory deprivation box, drugged in the medical center, or, as he threatened, shot on the spot and buried in the jungle.
Oh my gosh.
There was not much that one person can do to stop any of these things from happening. And in Jonestown, Jim Jones had the power over their life and their death. During one meeting, Jones became frustrated with Christine's vocal independence. He pointed the gun at her head and said that he could shoot her and no one would ever find out. Christine replied, "You can shoot me, but you're gonna have to respect me first." Jones repeated his threat with more menace, but Christine wouldn't back down. "You can do that," she said, "but you're going to have to respect me first." A moment later, Jones was standing before her, holding the gun to her head, shouting his rage at her defiance. She looked him in the eye and said calmly, "You can shoot me, but you will respect me." The standoff ended when Jones, not Christine, backed down.
That's amazing.
One badass woman.
Oh my God.
Grace Stone, as we said before, had been asking the government to help her regain custody of her son, John Victor. And another member of the group, Deborah Layton Blakely, had become publicly open about what was going on with Jones. Congressman Leo J. Ryan, he was from California, and he'd heard enough about what was going on in Jonestown and wanted to see it for himself. So he decided that he was going to take a trip down there. In November of 1978, this is like the end. Well, the end of the end, really. He toured Jonestown with a television crew, and Jones had been preparing the temple members for his visit for weeks. Every member knew that guards were watching their every move, and they were commanded to portray glorious utopian society. Role plays were conducted in which members were told exactly what to say when spoken to by the reporters, and any signs of dissatisfaction would be harshly dealt with away from prying eyes. The congressman was warmly greeted, and the reception was held on the first night, and it was great. And he seemed to be really impressed with the organization and the order that he saw, because he was going down there thinking, "I'm going to see abuse, see what I've been told is going on." But late into the night, one of the reporters who had come along with him secretly passed a note from a man in the crowd. He wanted to leave with the congressman. The next morning, the reporter showed the note to the congressman, and Ryan brought the issue up with Jones, which I feel is like the worst thing that you could do.
Right.
Like, if this guy did it in secret, he did it in secret for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Jones declared that anyone was free to go. And if they wanted to go, then they could go. That'd be fine. You can come and go as you please. So this prompted the congressman to make a public declaration that anyone who wanted to leave with him at the end of the weekend was most welcome to do so. Over the weekend, more people came forward. And then on the afternoon of the second day of the visit, a People's Temple member lunged at the congressman with a knife. Now, this event soured the proceedings and This made the proceedings a bit sour, obviously. Nobody wants to be lunged at with a knife. Mm. And the visitors were intent on getting out as fast as possible.
Smart.
Yes. He invited anyone who wanted to leave the compound to come back to California with him. And that afternoon, Congressman Ryan, a small group of defectors, and some visitors were driven to an airstrip in Port, which I probably butchered that name, but whatever. They were gunned down by Jones's order. By the time the shooting had stopped, there were 5 people dead, including Congressman Ryan, NBC correspondents Don Harris, NBC cameraman Bob Brown, and San Francisco Examiner photographer Greg Robinson. And one of the defectors, Patricia Parks, was also killed. And then 2 more defectors were seriously wounded. Back in Jonestown, Jim Jones had finally launched his revolutionary suicide. Cyanide and Valium were mixed into a batch of grape flavor-aid. It was not Kool-Aid. Everybody says, don't drink the Kool-Aid. But this is where that phrase came from. It was flavor-aid. Yeah. And the drink was distributed to members as Jones preached over the loudspeaker. When listening to the death tapes during the final hours of Jonestown, there's one voice that stands out against Jones, and that was the voice of Christine Miller. Jones started talking about how they were going to be ready to die because the plane of the congressman was going to be shot down, and it would be pinned on them, when really he had sent people to go kill them. Christine went back and forth with him about how he said that Russia would come to their aid if something went wrong. So now I'm going to read some from the some quotes from the death tapes. Or it's what they call the death tape, but really it's just the final recording. Christine said, "Why? I thought they said if we got in an emergency, they would give you a code to let them know." Jones: "No, they didn't. They gave us the code that they'd let us know if an issue, not us, create an issue for them. They said if we saw the country coming down, they'd agree they'd give us the code. They'd give us the code. You can check on there and see if it's on the code. Check with Russia." He's just like blabbering at this point, I feel like. Jesus. "Check with Russia to see if they'll take us in immediately. Otherwise, we die. I don't know what else to say to these people. But to me, death is not a fearful thing. It's living that's treacherous." And then there's applause from the crowd. Jones says, "I have never seen anything like this before in my life. I've never seen people take the law and do in their own hands and provoke us and try to purposely agitate and murder the children. There is no use, Christine. It's just not worth living like this. Not worth living like this." Christine said, "I think there are too few who left for 1,200 people to give their lives. For those people who left." Now they're talking about the defectors. Jones says, "Do you know how many left?" Christine says, "Oh, 20-odd? What's that? That's so small." Jones: "20-odd. Christine says, "Compared to what's here? Like, you got 20 people who left who are going to say something versus the 1,200 people that are here? Like, well, really, it's like 900 and something. But like, what's the point?" Jones says, "20-odd, but what's going to happen when they don't leave? I hope that they could leave, but what's going to happen if they don't leave?" She's confused at this point. She's like, "The people here?" He says, "Yeah, what's going to happen to us when they don't leave? When they get on the plane and the plane goes down?" "I don't think it'll go down." And then Jones says, "You don't think it'll go down?" Crowd says, "Yes, it will." He's just...
Oh my gosh.
Christine says, "I wasn't speaking about that plane." Like, she's not talking about the congressman plane. She's talking about the plane for us to go to Russia. Jones: To Russia? Do you think Russia's going to want... No, they're not going to. Do you think Russia's going to want us with all this stigma? We had really had some value, but now we don't have any value." Christine: "Well, I don't like it like that. I mean, I feel like as long as there's life..." What?
"It's, well, I don't see it like that."
Oh.
"You said I don't like it like that."
There you go. Christine says, "Well, I don't see it like that. I mean, I feel like as long as there's life, there's hope. That's my faith." Joan says, "Well, someday we're going to die. Some place that hope runs out, because everybody dies." The crowd says, "Right, right." Joan says, "I haven't seen anybody yet that didn't die. And I'd like to choose my own kind of death for a change. I'm tired of being tormented to hell. That's what I'm tired of." The crowd says, "Right, right." Jones is tired. What? And the crowd applauses. Jones says, "Tired of people's lives in my hands, and I certainly don't want your life in my hands. I'm going to tell you, Christine, without me, life has no meaning. I'm the best friend you'll ever have. And once I have to pay, I'm standing with Jara. I don't know who that is, but I'm standing with those people. Mm. They're part of me. I could detach myself. My attorney says detach myself. No, 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 no. I'd never detach myself from any of your troubles. I've always taken your troubles right on my shoulders, and I'm not going to change that now. It's too late. I've been running too long. Not going to change now. Maybe the next time you'll get to go to Russia. The next time around. He's talking about reincarnation.
Second Nature is a premium service solving a very unpremium problem. Regular air filter replacement. Even that sentence alone sounds a little dull, but trust us. It's a problem worth solving. Most people don't recognize they're supposed to change their filters every couple of months, and the ones that do barely have time to remember it. That's where Second Nature comes in. I recently subscribed to Second Nature when we bought our house, and I could not believe the amazing quality and options that are available for air filters for your home. I love the easy set it and forget it. I get a monthly filter because my son and I have really bad allergies. Second Nature made it so easy. And using our promo, you can get a month for free. We definitely recommend that you try it out and stick with them. We've been with them for almost 2 years now, and we absolutely love them. You can go to twosisterscult.com/secondnature. With a Second Nature subscription, you'll never forget your filters again.
This is what I'm talking about now, is in the dispensation of judgment. This is the Revolutionary Suicide Council. I'm not talking about self-destruction. I'm talking about what we have no other road. I will take your call. We will put it to the Russians, and I can tell you the answer now, but I'm a prophet. Call the Russians and tell them and see if they'll take us. I'm not afraid. Ugh. Not that I'm afraid to die. Joan says, I don't think you are. Christine says, by no means. Joan says, I don't think you are. Christine says, but I look at all the babies and I think they deserve to live. Joan says, I agree. Christine says, you know, Joan interrupts her. But also they deserve, what's more, they deserve peace. Christine says, we all came here for peace. Joan says, and have we had it? Christine in the crowd says, no. Joan said, I've tried to give it to you. I've laid down my life practically. I've practically died every day to give you peace. More like fucked everybody. Like,
right.
Where does this guy get off? Ugh. I didn't want to listen to his tapes because it's a lot more devastating because you can hear kids crying in the background and it's just not good. So I'm going to read it, continue reading it. And you still have no peace. You look better than I've seen you in a long while, but it's still not the kind of peace that I want to give you. The person's a fool who continues to say that you're a winner when you're a loser. Win one, lose two, what? I didn't hear you. Ma'am, you have to speak up. That's a sweet thought, though. Who said that? And he's just like talking to like whoever is in the crowd at this point. They've done it. Stone has done it. But somebody ought to live. Somebody. Can they talk? Can they not talk to San Francisco to see that Stone does not get by and his in this infamy? With this infamy, he has done the one thing that he wanted to do, to have us destroyed. And this goes on and on and on. But later, Joan says, for months I've tried to keep this thing from happening. But I now see it's the will. It's the will of Sovereign. It's the will of Sovereign Being that this happened to us, that we lay down our lives in protest against what's been done, that we lay down our lives in protest of what's being done. The criminality of the people, the cruelty of people, who walked out of here today? Did you notice who walked out? Mostly white people. Mostly white people walked. I'm so grateful for the ones who didn't. Those who knew who they are. There's no point. There's no point to this. We are born before our time. They won't accept us. And I don't think we should sit here and take any more time for our children to be endangered. For if they come after our children and we give them our children, then our children will suffer forever. The 276 children that were in Jonestown were the first to die that day. And those who refused to drink were forced by armed guards. When that stopped working, they injected some with a syringe of cyanide and shot the rest. Jones did decide how he went out that day. He was surrounded by his inner circle and died with one gunshot wound to the head. It's unclear if he took his own life or if it was his nurse, Ann Moore, who fatally shot herself afterwards in the same way. Marceline died next to him. In total, 918 people... Sorry. 918 people lost their lives in Jonestown that day, making it the largest number of American civilian casualties in a single non-natural event until 9/11. It's not really over, though. The U.S. tried to have the bodies buried on site, offering to foot the bill to the Guyanese government. But the Guyanese government wanted no part of the burial, and the families of the dead wanted their loved ones returned. The military was the only organization able to handle mass casualty recovery, and Dover Air Force Base in Delaware was assigned to the task. What happened there in the aftermath would become one of the first records of how deeply first responders can be affected by the trauma to which their jobs expose them. Loaded with waterproof canvas body bags and coffin-like metal transport containers, U.S. military helicopters shuttled the dead and recovery personnel alike between Guyana's capital and Jonestown, isolated deep in the jungle. There was a study done on the first responders, and the author said, "It is difficult to convey to someone what a week in a tropical environment can do to a dead human body. The conditions in Jonestown were compounded by rain and staggering humidity. The bodies bloat, and they change color, and they were infested by insects. Above all," the author writes, "the overpowering and unforgettable odor of just one body are beyond imaginable." By April of 1979, more than 300 bodies of those followers had been claimed by family members, but at Dover AFB, over 500 remained unclaimed, and over 200 were decomposed past the point of... Many relatives couldn't afford the military transport fee, which was nearly $500, for a family to bring home a loved one for a private burial.
That's incredibly fucked up.
Yeah. Even if they could have, no cemetery wanted... The communities didn't want to become pilgrimage sites for Jones's remaining U.S. followers and draw unwanted attention and people to their own towns. Eventually, a cemetery in Oakland, across the bay from the temple's former home in San Francisco, agreed to have the remains of hundreds of Jonestown's dead. And here are some final words from some of the survivors. "I did allow Jones to think for me, because I figured that he had a better plan," says former People's Temple member Hugh Fortson, whose wife and infant son were among those who died in Guyana. "I gave up my rights to him, as many others did." Jim Jones Jr., the first African-American boy to be, or person to be adopted by a white couple in Indiana. He was Jones's son. He lost his wife, but he survived because he was in Guyana's capital of Georgetown at the time doing a public relations for the temple. At now 57, he said in an interview, "There's some things about Jonestown I'm never going to deal with, and I'm okay with that. The mine's a dangerous neighborhood. Don't go alone." Stephen Jones, 59, he was the one who tried to commit suicide 3 times when he was 12. He said, "There were many people that were dear to me, and a good number of them that I was very dear to. I often thought about what it must have been like for them, for us not to be there, you know? And I ask their forgiveness." Today, a memorial in Oakland, California, serves as a tribute for those who have died. And that is the end of Jonestown.
Jesus. Yeah.
This was hard. And I'm sorry, but I'm also not sorry that I cried.
I also am crying.
Okay. Let's end this episode with some gratitude bits. Because we need a little bit of gratitude right now. Yeah, so I will go first, if that's all right.
Yeah, do.
I'm crying. Yeah, this was hard. I'm sorry, not sorry, but it was a really hard episode, and like I said, I was crying while typing this up, and it was rough. Yeah. Okay. So I have some crazy news. I mean, Jada, you know, but for our listeners, I have a man who lives across the street from me who is sending letters to all the neighbors, and they are very religiously damnation kind of letters.
Yeah.
And that,
the guy's crazy. I read it.
Yes.
I mean, it's...
we're going to do a mini episode. I'm going to read the whole letter. It is long and extensive, but we live near Fort Bragg. And so a lot of our neighbors are military. And some of the things in the letter were like, our military is going to burn. You and your children are going to burn. It's like neighbors came over to our house to talk to Chris to be like, we are offended by this guy. Did you get the letter too? And we did.
Yeah.
But all that aside, we're going to do a mini episode on him in the coming weeks. The next like 2 or 3 weeks, we'll do a mini episode. We'll talk about him and his ideas and how psychiatry.
He's got a YouTube channel, right?
Yes, he's got a YouTube channel. And we're going to talk all about that. But this weekend, I had a very witchy moment with Jude, and it was just,
ooh.
It was so I reached out to the podcast. I've mentioned it a few times on here, but it's called Sit for a Spell, and they're all about the occult and spells and witchy stuff. And I wanted to do a protection spell for my house. And so got some ideas from them. And so Jude and I burned some sage, and we burned it in the house, and like we went around the threshold, you know, the windows, we went around to the doors, and then outside the front of the house, we also went around the door and around the, like our front porch. And he really loved it. And I was, you know, talking to him. I was like, we're our ancestors. We're calling on our guides. We're calling on spirit animals. We're calling on all of them to protect us, to keep us safe. And I was like, do you think they'll keep us safe? And he was like, yeah, that sounds cool. And then like we had heard a bird, and the bird was like tweeting at us while we were doing our little ritual thing. And I was like, look, the bird is joining in. And Jude looked over and he's like, oh, look, there's a squirrel. He's joining in too.
Yes.
Cute. And I just love it.
I love it.
I loved it so much. And then, yes. And then I mixed the ash with salt to make black salt, and nice. Then put it in the front of our house. So,
yes.
It was really good. And I like explained it, what we were doing, why we were doing it. So we were trying to protect our family from people who would do us harm, because some of the stuff in that letter was very like threatening. And so, yeah, there's a whole thing going on with it. We're trying to get it taken care of. The FBI is informed about him. It's a whole thing. So yeah, it's going to be nuts. But yeah, that episode.
He had some really
hateful
stuff to say.
Yes. So that'll be interesting. So that was my, like, I was just so grateful for that moment with Jude, and just to like teach him more about my own spiritual practice, and just how open he was to it and stuff. It was really great. So
I love it when kids can kind of connect with the world in their own way.
Yes.
In your way also, you know what I mean? Bring their own kind of spice to it.
Yeah. I loved it. It was so good. Yeah. And he was loving it. He was like, ooh, we're burning stuff.
Yeah, right? That's what it's all about.
Exactly. What about you?
Well, I love how this downtime has given me like a lot of time to work on my inner stuff.
Ooh.
Yeah, you know, like a... when you find yourself being the person that you didn't want to be anymore, and you're like, wait, no, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
we agreed.
Hey, inner self, we had an agreement.
Exactly. But having, like, you know, so much not crowding in on your life at this time has been kind of a godsend.
Nice.
I'm grateful to her.
Yes, she is wonderful.
Yes, and I've been loving getting to know Gabe better, like his humor and how he learns, you know, with the homeschooling and stuff. He makes me laugh so much. He can get really annoying really fast too.
Yeah. But as per the use, it's just Oh, it's so nice. Yay. Yeah. I'm so happy. Well, hopefully that was a better upper than the way this episode went.
Yes, hug your loved ones.
Yes, hug them all.
I'm going to go hug my kid as soon as I get out of here.
So, were you in a cult? Do you have a favorite cult? Is there a cult that you want us to cover? No shame. Let us know. Mm-hmm. Do you want us to tell us a story? Do you have a crazy neighbor who's sending you letters? Let us know. I want to know. You can send us your stories at twosisterscult@gmail.com.
And we have a Patreon. So our weekly podcast will always be free, but if you donate to our Patreon, it'll support the show and allow us to create more amazing content for you. So you can go to twosisterscult.com and click on Patreon at the top of the menu. And you can get some exclusive perks there, like a shout out on the show, access to our top secret Facebook community. Shh, it's a cult. No.
Not like this Not one that cult. We talked about today.
If you join at the $10 level on Patreon, you'll get a Two Sisters and a Cult sticker and exclusive monthly bonus full-length episodes that will not be available on the podcast.
We have some pretty sweet merch available in our shop, and you can pick from decal stickers, t-shirts, and other fun stuff. Just click shop in the menu at twosisterscult.com.
The best way for you to help us out on the show is to like, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to tell a friend who you think would like us.
Yes, and if you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Two Sisters Cult. Come hang out with us. And please tell us that we were not the only ones who cried during this episode.
Seriously.
Because, okay, catch you on the flip side.
Don't join that cult.